two sheets, so as not to damage the platen. "Leave your messages for St. Nick or Father Christmas or whatever his name is," he told the kids when they came back downstairs, smelling of toothpaste and fresh, clean flannel. Jill wrote hers first, one clack at a time, letter by letter, key by key. "Dear Santa Claus, thank you for coming again, and thank you for the nurse kit and my honey walker. I hope you give me both. Merry Christmas. I love you. Jill Buell." For his letter, Davy insisted on his own separate piece of paper. He told Jill that he didn't want to confuse Santa. Getting the two pages into the typewriter and lined up straight took him a few tries. 12-24-53. "Dear Santa Claus, my sister Jill believes in you, and so do I still. You know what I want for this Christmas, and believe me, you have never disappointed me. Here is some cold milk, of course, and snack cakes that are also called cookies. Next year, you have to bring presents for baby Connie, because she will be old enough by then, okay? If the milk is warm, make it cold with your finger. David Amos Buell." Davy left his letter hanging out of the typewriter carriage, posing the machine to face the fireplace, where Santa was sure to see it. "You guys should arrange your presents in piles under the tree to make things simple come morning," Virgil said. Santa always left the wished-for presents that were his responsibility unwrapped on Christmas morning, ready for immediate play, so Virgil and Dell would have time for their morning coffee. The family gifts, from Uncle Gus and Aunt Ethel, from Uncle Andrew and Aunt Marie, from Goggy and Pop, from Nana and Leo, from as far away as Urbana, Illinois, and as close as Holt's Bend, had been collecting under the tree, wrapped in colorful paper for days, growing with almost every stop at the village post office. Once twin stacks of gifts labeled Davy and Jill had been built up, the kids put the records back in their sleeves and the albums back up on the shelf. Dell asked Jill to tune the big cabinet radio to the Christmas Eve programs for seasonal music that was not about a deer with a red nose. Cookies had been baked on December 23rd. Jill pulled them out of the Kelvinator and ranged them on a plate while Davy poured milk into a tall glass. Then they carried the snacks to the coffee table, setting them beside the Remington. From then on, it was a waiting game. Davy added another log to the fire as Jill reacquainted herself with her father's lap while the radio played Christmas carols, celebrating wise men and holy nights and the birth of Jesus. Not long after, Virgil carried his sleeping daughter up to her bed, sliding her between the covers, marveling at the softness of his little girl's closed eyes and the lips that were Dell's in perfect miniature. In the front room, Davy was on the sofa, leaning close against his mother as she played her fingers in his hair. "She swallowed it hook, line, and sinker," he said. "You're a good big brother," Dell told him. "Ah, heck, anyone would do it." Davy was looking into the fire. "When Jill first asked me if Santa was really real, like she was afraid to ask you and wanted it to be a secret between just us, I didn't know what to say." "How'd you handle it, honey?" "That's when I came up with a plan, to have an answer for every question she had. How does he make it to every house? He goes super fast, and there aren't all that many houses anyway. What about a house with no chimney? He could use the oven or the furnace." "Touching the milk to make it cold," Dell whispered to her son, as she brushed hair off the soft skin of his forehead. "So smart. So quick. Well, that was Cinchy. He's a magic man." "You'll have to do the same for Connie soon." "Of course. It's my job now." Virgil came back downstairs to Daddy's chair, as a carol, in Latin, was crooning out of the mouth of Bing Crosby. "Dad, how does radio work?" Davy wanted to know. At 10:15, Davy went off to bed, announcing this might have been the best Christmas Eve ever. "Should I put on some coffee?" Dolores asked. "You'd better," Virgil said, following her into the kitchen, where he stopped her from reaching for the coffee can. wrapped his arms around her and kissed her. She kissed back, both of them feeling that such a kiss was one of the reasons they were still married. The kiss lasted longer than either of them expected, and then they smiled at each other. Dell prepared the coffee as Virgil stood next to her at the stove.
"Next year, let's try to get to midnight mass," Dolores said. "We are raising godless kids."
"Just Davy," Virgil chuckled. Davy had been born 7 months after their wedding day.
"The midnight mass is so beautiful.
3 kids, up all hours on Christmas Eve. The drive all the way to St. Mary's. If we tried that tonight with the snow?
The McElhaney's, Madge.
Ruth McElhaney is as nutty as a can of Planters. Ed doesn't dare cross her.
Still, the candles, the music, so pretty."
Dell knew that in years to come they'd make the drive to midnight mass. Not because he didn't dare cross her, but because he loved to give her what she wanted. But for this Yuletide, there was just his hand over hers in the quiet, warm kitchen of the snowbound house as they sat with their coffee. Virgil put his overshoes back on and pulled on his heavy coat, cracking open the front door just wide enough for him to slip through. Nearly 3 inches of snow had collected. Hatless, he went to the Plymouth's trunk to retrieve Santa's bounty. Not wanting to risk a fall on the frozen walk, Virgil made 2 trips carrying small loads. Closing the trunk, he paused a moment to ponder the final hour of Christmas Eve 1953. A cold night, yes, but Virgil had been colder. Stepping carefully, he felt the pull of a ghost pain where his lower leg used to be. He took the 5 steps to the front door, 1 at a time. Dell laid out the nurse's kit by Jill's stack of treasures. Honey Walker, the walking doll just like a real little girl, needed batteries. Santa had batteries. Before too long, Davy would find his space rocket launch base with towers and soldiers and spring launchers that, once Virgil assembled the components, actually flung spaceships into the void. Connie would delight in a new play blanket and a set of blocks direct from the North Pole. When all was laid out and Honey Walker had taken a test stroll, Virgil and Dell sat close together on the sofa and kissed some more. After they'd sat, arms entwined, quiet and still for a while, Dell eyed the fire, then rose up.
"I'm done in," she confessed. "Try to answer on the first ring, honey, and give him my love."
"I will." Virgil checked his watch. It was almost 11:30. 7 minutes after midnight, the shrill peal of the phone broke the silent night. As instructed, Virgil picked up before the first ring gave way to the second. "Merry Christmas," he said. An operator was on the line. "This is a long-distance call for Virginia Buell from Amos Bowling."
"Speaking. Thank you, operator."
As always, the operator had gotten the name wrong.
"Sir, your party is on the line," the operator said, clicking off.
"Thanks, honey," said the caller. "Merry Christmas, Virgin."
Virgil smiled at his nickname. Because of Amos Bowling, the whole outfit had come to call him Virgin.
"Where the heck are you, bud?"
"San Diego. I was over across the border yesterday."
"You don't say."
"Let me tell you something about Mexico, Virgin. The place is loaded with cantinas and cat houses. Nice and hot, too. How deep is the snow up there in Dogpatch?"
"Seen worse, but I'm sitting by a nice fire, so no complaints."
"Dolores still burdened with you?"
"Gives her love."
"You are one lucky son of a bitch, and that gal could have done better."
"I know that, but I haven't told her." Both men chuckled.
Amos Bud Bowling forever joked that when Dolores Gomez was taken off the market by Virgil the Virgin Buell, there was no longer any point in getting married. There had been a time, more than 13 years before, when someone else in the outfit might have come along to snag Dolores. Ernie, Clyde, or Bob Clay, or either of the 2 Johnny boys would have all taken a run at her, had Virgil not met her first. A dance at the Red Cross Center
was so chock-a-block with soldiers, sailors, and airmen that Virgil needed some air and a few moments away from the crowd. He stepped outside for a smoke and found himself lighting a cigarette for a brown-eyed girl named Dolores Gomez. By the end of the next morning, she and Virgil had danced, laughed, had griddle cakes with lots of coffee, and kissed. Two lives changed forever. In the years since, Bud had not married, and Virgil knew he never would. Not landing Dolores had nothing to do with it. Virgil had, years before, figured Bud was one of those men like his father's youngest brother, Uncle Russell. Virgil had been around his uncle rarely, the last time during the long day that was his grandmother's funeral. Uncle Russell had driven from New York City with a friend, a man named Carl, who called Russell Rusty. After the service, the burial, and the reunion dinner at the house that ended with coffee and pie, Carl and Rusty drove off into the night, headed all the way back to New York City, still wearing their funeral suits. Virgil remembered his father later saying, under his breath, that women were neither the weakness nor the passion of his kid brother. Bud Bowling had plenty of weaknesses and a few passions, but just as for Uncle Russell, none of them involved women. "So," Virgil said, "how you been, Bud?"
The same," Bud answered. "Came down here 3 months ago from a town up north near Sacramento. That's the state capital, you know. Bought a Buick secondhand, drove it down. Nice town, Navy town. Every cab driver will tell you he was at Pearl Harbor."
"You working at all?"
"Not until someone makes me."
"I know I say this every year, but here it is. I got room for you at the shop. In fact, I could use you with the way things have been going.
Doing well, are you?"
"Bud, I've got so many orders I'm working 6 day weeks."
"Hell on earth!"
"I'm serious, Bud. You come work with me, and you'll be set for years."
"I'm already set for years."
"I'll pay you more than you're worth."
"I ain't worth a flat plug nickel, Virgin, you know that."
Virgil laughed.
"Then just come by for a visit. In the summer, hop in that Buick, and we'll go fishing." "You country boys always make a big deal about fishing."
"I'd just like to see you, Bud. Del, too. Little Davy would be over the moon to meet you."
"Maybe next year."
"You say that every Christmas." Virgil kept going. "Come see us, Bud. We'll go to midnight mass. We'll say prayers for all the fellows."
"I've already said all the prayers for all the fellows I'm ever going to pray for."
"Aw, come on. Next year will be 10 years.
10 years?
Bud let the static crackle on the long-distance line.
10 years for who? 10 years for what?"
Virgil felt like a fool. Bob Clay had been killed in Normandy on the same day that Ernie, wounded in his right thigh, had bled out. No one realized his artery had been severed because the pool of blood under Ernie never spread, but was absorbed by the damp ground. Nobody saw it. Attention was not paid as closely as it should have been, since there were Germans trying to kill them from somewhere on the other side of a thick hedgerow in the French Bocage. Mortar rounds coming at them from the unseen enemy kept the outfit pinned down for nearly an hour. Bud and Virgil were in two squads sent to hack through the roots and trees, impossible but for the use of grenades. They flanked the enemy position and killed all of them, but at a cost. Bud's squad leader, Corporal Emery, was cut in two, literally, by a German machine gun. Virgil was unsuccessful giving first aid to Sergeant Castle, who took 3 rounds in the chest that severed his spine. Burke's head wound was beyond aid, and a fellow named Corcoran lost an arm that was cut clean from his shoulder, and he was moved back to an aid station. No one knew if he lived or not. A week later, Johnny Boy disappeared, and the other Johnny Boy cracked. And one by one, others in the outfit were lost in ways soldiers are lost. For 58 days, from the 7th of June to early August, the outfit was either fighting or moving toward the fighting. Bud was promoted to corporal, and Virgil's teeth began to go rotten from eating nothing but K-rations. On day 59, the outfit rested at a camp in France. There were cots with blankets and relatively warm showers, hot food, and all the coffee a GI could stomach. Later, a big tent served as a theater where movies were played. Clyde was transferred to intelligence because he spoke decent French. Every airplane in the sky was either the RAF or the USAAF, and the word was the Germans were on the run, that the worst of the fighting had happened, and that they'd all be home by Christmas. New guys came in from the replacement depots and had to be drilled and trained. Bud was tough on all of them, and Virgil didn't want to learn any of their names. In the middle of September, the outfit was given new uniforms, rearmed, and loaded into transports for an offensive in Holland. Four of the trucks slammed into each other in the dark of night. Five soldiers were killed. Three were so injured they were no good for the war anymore. The trucks were repaired and moving by daylight. 3 days later, the outfit was surprised by a German attack just before dawn. The command post was blown up, leading to a confused, chaotic battle that had Virgil and Bud fighting the enemy hand to hand. By chance, three tanks, British Cromwells, were close enough to roar in and overpower the German advance. Many of the new guys were killed in what was their first time in combat, and plenty happened that made no sense. No sense at all. Virgil lost count of the days before he found himself back in France, where he and Bud slept and slept and slept. They walked around huge ancient cathedrals and played football. Movie stars came to put on shows. There was a cat house not far from the barracks, a place called Madame Sophia's. While many of the officers had 3-day passes in Paris, Bud and Virgil and the other enlisted men drilled and trained more replacements, even in the rain. There was a different movie every night. Then came the coldest December on record, and the Germans roared into Belgium. The outfit was loaded onto trucks, driven hell-bent into the night, and dropped off on a road somewhere between Paris and Berlin. Virgil appreciated the spirit of one driver, a colored fellow, who gave him a pack of lucky strikes and a wish for God to look out for him. The outfit marched on roads and across ice-solid fields, along trails dragged out in the gathered snow, hauling ammo and supplies for themselves, as well as for others who are already up ahead in the fighting, which Virgil could see in the distance like 4th of July fireworks. They fought along with the paratroopers who'd taken heavy casualties, moving forward in a show of arms meant to convince the Germans that an entire division was at the ready to take them on. The ruse worked, but lives were lost. The outfit came under artillery fire in the Belgian woods, and some guys were blown apart, vaporized. Then Virgil, Bud, and the outfit were sent marching the other way, through Bastogne proper. They passed a neatly arranged stack of dead soldiers just outside the church, burned out useless tanks with their treads thrown off, and a pair of cows eating hay a farmer had stalked. The farmer and the cows seemed oblivious to the Germans, who were trying to retake the port at Antwerp and to the general hullabaloo. The cold cut them all to the bone. It was inescapable. The cold killed some men in the outfit. Sleep was so rare, some guys went nuts and had to be sent back into Bastogne. The hope was that they could gather themselves so they could return to the cold and the fighting. A new kid, something-something junior, had the watch. Virgil was in the hole, under the roof of branches, on top of the pine needles that lined the floor, wrapped in a single GI blanket. Sleep was a joke. He had a few Charms fruit candies left in a roll, so popped two into his mouth. One remained, so he rose up from the frozen ground floor of the hole and palmed the final square of hard candy into the hand of the new kid. "Merry fucking Christmas," Virgil whispered. "Thanks, Virgin." "Junior, call me Virgin again and I'll crack you one." "Isn't your name Virgin?"
not to fucking new guys. The hole was at the far left of these woods, 2 trees in from the edge of the rise, overlooking in daylight a Belgian farmer's barren field, and just beyond it, a collection of houses built along a narrow road leading northeast. At night, there was only the void. Somewhere down there were supposed to be the German soldiers. The rest of the outfit was in holes and shelters of their own, spaced off to the right. This was the main line of defense, theoretically. In reality, the idea of an MLD was as laughable as that of a cozy nap. The line was so thin, there was no listening post forward of the trees. There was little heavy armor in the rear. The big guns had only a few shells left. There was no kitchen, and thus no hot food, for miles. This hole was the 7th Virgil had chipped out of the frozen ground, and covered with tree limbs, since they had walked through Bastogne. Virgil didn't want to dig any more of them. Moving to another position meant shouldering weapons and gear, carrying it who knew how far or for how long, digging another hole, building another shelter, working up the sweat that, in the sub-zero winter, caused a man's uniform to freeze to his back. Frostbite had taken more men off the line than wounds from enemy fire. Some of the freezing guys had been able to get out before the encirclement. Those that hadn't had already lost toes and fingers, some even their feet and hands. Virgil didn't want to be one of those guys. He kept his one extra pair of socks tied together and draped across the back of his neck under his uniform to hang in his armpits. His body temperature, what was left of it, would dry the socks out some. He hoped he could always have that reserve of semi-dry socks to avoid frostbite. He also hoped Hitler was going to come walking across the field waving a white hanky to surrender personally to PFC Virgil Buell, right after Rita Hayworth dropped by to offer a blowjob.
"I sure could use some coffee," Junior whispered. "Tell you what," Virgil whispered back, "I'll start a warm and toasty fire to percolate us up a couple of pots. I got some cake mixings, too, and we'll make a batch for the whole squad and shut the fuck up, you fucking fucker."
"Butterfly! Butterfly!"
A sharp whisper came from the dark to the left of the hole, the password for the day.
"McQueen!"
Virgil hissed in response. A second later, Sergeant Bud Bowling tumbled into the shelter, weaponless. He had been trying to sleep during the daylight hours, covered up in a hole of his own. Once it got dark, he roamed the front in silence, alone, returning at daylight to report whatever he had seen to the CP before tucking away into his dark hole again.
"Krauts, 25 of them. Who the fuck are you?"
Bud meant the new guy, Junior. Before a name could be offered, Bud said, "Never mind," and gave an order. "Give me your rifle and get to the CP and tell them a crowd probe is coming on the left." Junior's eyes went wide. He had yet to be in any combat. As he kicked his way up and out of the hole, Bud repeated, "Crowd probe on our left," and the kid was gone. Bud readied the M1 rifle, tucking spare ammo clips into his jacket. Virgil lifted the machine gun in one piece, tripod and all, and faced it at the foxhole's 9 o'clock.
"I was right ahead of them, Virgin. They see you? No fucking Lugerhead ever sees me,"
the men whispered with the confidence of experienced soldiers, which they were. Not like 22-year-old boys, which they also were. A footfall from the darkness cracked hardened ice.
"Light 'em up,"
Bud hissed. PFC Virgil Buell pulled the trigger of his machine gun, spitting fire into a column of enemy soldiers not 3 yards in front of him. Bright muzzle flashes and red tracer rounds illuminated the shapes of bodies and the trunks of trees as other American boys took to their weapons. A fury of fighting lit up the woods, and the thin line of defense took on the look of an impenetrable wall. In a flash as well-defined as that from the speed graphic camera ringside at a prize fight, Virgil saw the helmet of a German soldier explode in a cloud of fine, blood-red mist and soggy clumps of what had been the man's head. The German soldiers spread out quickly and spewed death themselves. Bud raced up just high enough to aim his rifle and squeeze out a full clip into the invading force. 8 continuous blams
spreading his rounds with a geometric precision until the pickling of his empty clip flying out of its breech meant his ammo was spent. Instinctively, Bud reloaded and was raised up again when a body came crashing into the shelter through the pine branch roof. The German was firing as he fell, hitting Virgil in his left knee without Virgil feeling a thing. Another shot made the fingers on Virgil's left hand sting like a hornet's bite. "Fuck you," Bud yelled, driving the butt of his M1 across the German's jaw. "Fucker," he yelled, smashing the German's face twice more. Someone began firing parachute flares that lit up the woods in a harsh limelight, and Bud saw he had broken the nose and smashed the jaw of the German, who lay glassy-eyed and motionless. He spun his rifle around, pointed the muzzle at the middle button on the soldier's uniform, fired two rounds point-blank, and ended the man's life. "One less of you fuckers," he said to the dead enemy soldier. The small reserve force of American boys was coming forward now. What had started as a probe by the enemy had become a severe and deadly mistake for them. A pursuit was underway as the Germans retreated. Virgil ceased fire and was breaking down his weapon to join the move forward when he realized something was wrong. His hand was sticky and his leg was numb. "My leg fell asleep," he yelled. Trying to stand, Virgil fell back on top of the faceless, lifeless German. He tried to stand again, but his left leg bent the wrong way at the knee, and Virgil could not figure out what had happened. Luckily, Bud Bowling was there to help him up. But rather than getting him on his feet, Bud squatted, pulled Virgil over his shoulders, and lifted him clean off the ground. That much, Virgil remembered, of Christmas Eve, 1944. Somewhere between the foxhole and the aid station to the rear, he slipped into the slumber of the unconscious. Virgil felt like a goddamn fool. 10 years was an anniversary for him, because the war ended for PFC Buell on Christmas Eve, 1944. He awoke at an aid station in Bastogne proper, after the American tanks had come and the German advance had collapsed. A few days later, he woke up again at a field hospital in France. Weeks later, he became one of thousands of wounded men in hospitals in England. When Germany surrendered and the war was over in Europe, Virgil began to think of himself as one lucky bastard. His left leg was gone, severed above the knee, and three fingers of his left hand were now stumps, wrapped in so many bandages he looked like he was wearing a gauze catcher's mitt. But he still had two thumbs, one good leg, his sight, and his manhood. Compared to many other guys in those hospitals and on the ship home, Virgin felt like he had won the 1945 Irish sweepstakes. All he really wanted back was his wedding band, which had been lost somewhere in those woods in Belgium. Amos Bud Bowling stayed in Germany for his full enlistment, which meant the duration of the war plus 6 months. While Virgil was being treated for his wounds and the deadly infections that came with them, Bud was attacking the Siegfried Line and killing his way into Nazi Germany. Then he breached the Rhine River and raided the Elbe, swept south into pockets of enemy country that had seen no signs of the war in the 4.5 years it had raged around him. Bud had never been wounded, but he'd seen too many who had been, and too many killed. He had also killed a great many German men and boys. He had ended the lives of German soldiers who had been looking to surrender and survive, but instead found Sergeant Bud Bowling's merciless eyes. 18 German officers were shot dead by his hand, alone, or two or three at a time, off the roads and under the cover of trees, behind farmhouse walls, or out in open fields. Bud used his .45 sidearm to wring a justice out of the war that made sense only to him. Bud killed one last German in August 1945. He had heard stories about a particular local, a former Nazi party official, who was using the false name of Wolf. He found the man standing in a line of refugees who were hoping to return to their home cities in different parts of what had been the Third Reich. When Wolf produced his papers, Bud ordered him out of the line. Behind a low brick wall, Bud drew his sidearm and shot Wolf square through his neck and calmly stood over the former Nazi bigwig as he thrashed about for the last few moments of his life. Bud Bolding never talked of any of this. He never talked of the camps he'd seen, either. Virgil never knew any of the specifics, but he suspected. He saw the emptiness, the difference in his friend.
How long are you thinking of staying in San Diego, Bud? Maybe a week, maybe a year. May head up to Los Angeles for the new year and catch that big parade. The Rose Parade? Yeah. Supposed to be gorgeous. I'd ask you where you're headed, but I already know. The shop, for 6 days a week. I like my work, Bud. I don't know that I could just amble about like you do. Virgin, I'd rather punch a cop than a clock, the men laughed. Merry Christmas to you, and you'll be mighty welcome should you amble our way sometime. Always good to talk to you, Virgin. Glad you're a happy man. You deserve such blessings. Thanks to you, Bud. Almost 1954, can you believe it? There you are with Dell and Davy and Jill and, Connie? I get the new one's name right? Connie it is. Virgil the Virgin has 3 kids. I understand the biology, but the reality's a fucking mystery.
The men gave each other a round of holiday wishes, repeated goodbyes, and hung up. They would talk again in a year. Virgil sat in the quiet, watching the fire until 1 a.m. Then he pulled up out of Daddy's chair to bank the flames so that Davy would have embers to start up the Yule logs. He found the plug for the Christmas tree lights and yanked it from the wall socket, using the thumb, forefinger, and knuckle stumps of his left hand. After almost forgetting, he stopped in front of the plate that held Santa's cookies and ate 3 of them. He hesitated, then took a bite out of a 4th cookie, put it back on the plate, and drank a few sips of the milk that had gone warm. In darkness, he found his way to the stairs, climbing 1 riser at a time, his left shoe matching his right foot. He checked on both of the sleeping kids and Connie in her crib beside Dell's side of the bed. Dell always laid his pajamas out for him. So once he was out of his trousers and had undone the straps and buckles of his prosthetic leg, he set the thing to rest beside the chair and wriggled into his sleeping clothes. A short stutter of a hop got him into bed. As he did every night, he found Dell's lips and kissed them softly, causing her to purr through her sleep. Virgil pulled the covers over him, the sheet, the 2 heavy blankets, and the thick quilt. He rested his head on his pillow after the long day and at last closed his eyes. As he did almost every night, he saw the lightning-like image of a soldier's helmet exploding in a cloud of blood-red mist. He saw the soggy clumps of what had been the man's head. Virgil forced himself to think of something else, anything else. He searched his mind for an image and settled on a vision of Bud Bolling as a young man, 22 years old, standing in the warm sunshine on a California street, part of a great throng of people all with smiling faces, cheering on a parade of floats covered with roses.
A junket in the City of Light. What brown fox jumped quickly over dogs that are lazy? Hey, this writing machine actually works. What the hell has happened? Who am I today? Still Rory Thorpe, I guess, but who is he? Last night, just hours ago, I was the guy in a huge movie that everyone was talking about, the guy who made out with a glamorous beauty, a guy with a fine ass, in the capitals of Europe,
and America. I was hustled around like a politician, into cars and into ballrooms filled with camera-toting, question-hollering reporters. I waved a seas of people, many of whom waved back, even though no one knew who I am, even though I am, in fact, a no-one. Although, I have in my possession certain documents that reveal Willa Sachs's top secret code name. It's Eleanor Flintstone. I was 2 days into taking the city of Paris by storm with a third to go, and day three was going to have fireworks. I had all my expenses paid. I was wearing free clothes. I could ask for a sandwich whenever I wanted. Even though I was kept so busy, I didn't have time for much more than a few bites. But this morning, all that is over. I have to be out of my room at checkout time. Too bad. This is a nice hotel. The Nazis stayed here. A good rule of thumb when traveling in Europe: stay in places with a Nazi past. The place in Rome had been Gestapo headquarters during the war. Big rooms, high ceilings, beautiful garden. In Berlin, the hotel had been leveled when the Russians clobbered the Nazis who were hiding in it. To rub in their victory, the commies never bothered to rebuild it or much of anything else in that part of East Berlin. When the wall came down, the hotel went back up, and now the joint has a special room just for smoking cigars. In London, the old lady of a grand hotel had been bombed by the Luftwaffe sometime between the Nazi glories of Rome and the ass-kicking they took from the Reds a few years later. The Queen has had dinner there twice since 1973. Finally, this Parisian hotel had been the headquarters of the German occupation staff. They say Hitler had a cup of coffee on one of the balconies before he drove around to take in the sights of his conquered city of light. All this has been free of cost for me, including the hotels in L.A. and Chicago and New York, on the studio's dime, because I play Caleb Jackson in Cassandra Rampart 3, Destiny at Hand. Cassandra Rampart, a.k.a. Willa Sachs, a.k.a. Eleanor Flintstone. Day three of my junket, my press tour, would have been another wild ride of the day. Instead, I have to pack my bags and check out by 1 p.m. I'm sorry, by 13 o'clock. To Rory Thorpe. Carbon copy, Irene Burton, etc. From Annette Laboud. Regarding Paris press schedule.
Welcome to Paris. We know you must be exhausted, but want you to know how thrilled we all are to be working on the French release of Cassandra Rampart 3, Destiny at Hand. Our colleagues in Rome, Berlin, and London tell us the movie has been welcomed with wild enthusiasm, thanks to you. Our tracking numbers are just 3 points off Cassandra Rampart 2, Agent of Change, and only 10 points off Cassandra Rampart, The Beginning. For a sequel, these are fantastic numbers. It seems audiences are responding to the sexual tension between Cassandra and Caleb. We all feel France is a good territory for the film, as the Cassandra Rampart universe has a mega following on all social media platforms. As Irene Burton and the marketing department may have already explained to you, France does not allow the promotion of films via paid spots on television, which is why you may notice a few more on-camera interviews during your stay with us. These interviews are crucial in the French market. You have done so well on the U.S. tour and in Rome, Berlin, London. There is no question you are warmed up. So, have fun. Below is the schedule for the next 3 days, separate schedule for Eleanor Flintstone. Day one. 1:10, approximately. Arrived Charles de Gaulle Airport from London. Transport to hotel. 7:10. Grooming in room 4114. 7:40 to 8. Live appearance on Nosotros Cacahuates. This is the most popular young adult morning show in Spain with a strong online presence, 4.1 million views. They have come to Paris especially for CR3DAH. 8:05. Transfer to Media Center on third floor. 8:15 to 8:45. Print Media Roundtable, number 1, approximately 16 outlets, list available.
8:50 to 9:20. Print media roundtable number 2. Approximately 16 outlets. List available. 9:25 to 9:55. Print media roundtable number 3. Approximately 16 outlets. List available. 10 to 10:30. Print media roundtable number 4. Approximately 16 outlets. List available. 10:35 to 11:05. Print media roundtable number 5. Approximately 16 outlets. List available. 11:10 to 11:40. Print media roundtable number 6. Approximately 16 outlets. List available. 11:45 to 11:50. Reddit AM session for United States. Break. 12 to 13. Social influencers, mini interviews, 3 to 5 minutes each. The social influencers have at least 1.5 million followers. Each will have a specific request for their postings. Some will be very quick. Others will be limited to 5 minutes. 1305 to 1400. Photo shoot on hotel roof. Note, Eleanor Flintstone will join you for last 10 minutes. 1405 to 1445, lunch interview with Paris Match. Note, a photographer will be present. 1450 to 1500, radio interview with TSR1. 1505 to 1515, radio interview with RTF3. 1520 to 1530, radio interview with FRT2. 1540 to 1600, informal coffee with approved social media outlets, approximately 20, with a minimum of 3.5 million followers, list on request. 1605 to 1610, touch-ups. 1615 to 1645, live TV remote from balcony for Belgian TV PM Today. Note, Eleanor Flintstone will be joining you at 1630. 1700. Proceed by car to Studio Du Roy for Air France promotional shoot. This will play on all Air France international flights to support CR3 DAH opening. Shoot will take approximately 3 hours. 2000. Approximate. Proceed by car to Restaurant Le Chat. Dinner hosted by UPIC. Note, a photographer will be present. After dinner, you are free to stay or return to hotel. Rory Thorpe thanked his lucky stars for Irene Burton. Those stars had been mighty benevolent over the last 2 years. He'd been in a movie with none other than Willa Sachs, Cassandra Rampart herself. He had money in the bank for the first time in his life. He was getting a free trip to Europe out of the deal. All he had to do was give some interviews over there. His enthusiasm had Irene Burton mutely laughing her ass off. Irene was 66 years old, had worked in marketing for every one of the 6 major film studios, and now lived in semi-retirement in a beach house in Oxnard. Far enough away from Hollywood to avoid the daily stresses of showbiz, yet close enough to pop in when she was needed to clean up the occasional PR flameout. 11 years ago, she escorted a young, talented, and beautiful actress through the press tour for a horrible movie called Dementia 40, which did lousy business, but is now legendary for introducing audiences to the young, talented, and beautiful Willa Sachs. The press called her Willa Sex for a few years, a fitting moniker. But now, Willa was Cassandra Rampart, a one-woman industry who had her own line of exercise clothes, a home for orphan pets, and a foundation that promoted literacy in third world nations. The first 2 Cassandra Rampart movies had grossed $1.75 billion worldwide. Willa Sachs didn't just command $21 million a movie plus profits. She commanded respect. "Irene," Willa told her on the phone. "You gotta help me." "Sup, punkin?" Irene called all her young actors punkin. "Rory Thorpe is as dumb as a box of hair." "Who is Rory Thorpe?" "The guy in my latest thing. I just saw his EPK. The electronic press kit is a house-controlled interview given to the press as background for a movie.
Most of his answers start with, well, it's like, you know, we have a junket coming up and I can't go around the world with Doofus McGillicuddy as my co-star. He needs to be told what the fuck not to do.
I can do that.
So Irene did. She took Rory shopping at Fred Siegel and Tom Ford for the clothes he'd need, casual look outfits for interviews, and black tie tuxes for premier galas. No charge. She took him luggage shopping at T. Anthony for the right trunks and suitcases at a steep discount the studio covered. So those outfits would be ready to don at a moment's notice. He'd be photographed in two shots with one of the most beautiful women in the world and needed to look like he rated the position. He'd be answering the same questions 1,000 times over. So she drilled into him the talking point memos the studio had provided. CR3DAH brings the Sea Rampart universe its most compelling and sophisticated film, for she is not just a heroine for our times, but a woman for the ages. Please use woman for the ages whenever describing Cassandra. Irene had perfected her ability to keep her laughter to herself when one of her clients said something really stupid or naive. In Rory's case, his thinking his first ever trip to Europe was going to be free. Oh, punkin, she told him. You'll be working your ass off. The junket began in Los Angeles, 3 days jammed with interviews, photo shoots, video conferences, Q&A sessions, forums with fan bases, and as many talk show appearances as possible, each needing an hour of pre-interviews with the segment producers. Irene saw to it that Rory was well-dressed, well-groomed, and well-versed in what the fuck not to do. And there was the trip to the Comic-Con convention in San Diego. Willa Sachs needed a team of bodyguards to keep the fans at bay. Many of them were costumed as Cassandra, the former Secret Service agent, with computer chips implanted in her brain, formula-enhanced super-strong sinews, able to communicate subconsciously with the Seven, the extraterrestrials who live among us, aliens who may be good guys, may be bad guys, and who etc., 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 you get the idea. Many Comic-Conners were costumed as the Seven. No one was dressed as Caleb Jackson, pro surfer, software whiz, because no one had seen the movie yet. The fans seemed thrilled at the screening of a 20-minute teaser of the movie, making it a trending topic for most of the day on both Twitter and Poppit. 2 days later, in Chicago, the teaser was screened on the campus of Northwestern University, the alma mater of Willa Sachs herself. Her old dorm was renamed in her honor. Irene steered Rory through 2 days of interviews, a parade, a charity volleyball match, the dropping of a puck at a Blackhawks hockey game, and a screening of the movie to benefit literacy in Africa that was held at the same theater where the gangster John Dillinger had been gunned down. 4 days of junket were held in New York City, starting with a press conference staged in the ballroom of the Waldorf Astoria, attended by 152 media outlets. Rory did not get a question until Willa had talked for 30 minutes, mostly of the challenges of shooting with the new FlitCam digital process and the new SPFX system called Digimax. She was a producer on the film, after all, having optioned the rights to the Cassandra Rampart graphic novel in 2007 for a mere $10,000. She laughed off questions about her husband's investment genius and his supposed bedroom prowess. "Guys," Willa protested, "Bobby is a banker." Bobby was her husband, and he was worth $1.2 billion. Willa told the press that he really was a regular dude who had to be told to take out the trash. That led to Rory being asked, "How does it feel for a guy like you to kiss the most beautiful woman in the world?" "It's a kiss for the ages," he said. Irene smiled, knowing she'd done her work well. The crammed room remained silent, save the clicking of camera shutters. When the press conference ended, Willa was whisked away as more questions were shouted at her. Irene escorted Rory into a smaller ballroom set up with multiple round tables,
each crowded with journalists and their microphones. Rory spent 20 minutes at each table, one after another, with no break, answering versions of the same three questions. What is it like working with Willa Sachs? What is it like kissing Willa Sachs? Is that really your ass in the hurricane scene? Irene took him to the media center on the 8th floor to sit through a total of 57 television interviews, lasting no more than 6 minutes each, all held in the same room, Rory seated in the same chair, with a one sheet of the movie behind him. In the poster, Willa was staring off into space, a look of ferocious concentration on her beautiful face. Her torso, clad in a tight sweater, a rip exposing her shoulder and the top sphere of her left breast. Behind her was a mosaic of images from the movie. An explosion, dark figures running in a tunnel, a massive cresting wave, and Rory wearing a headset and looking at a computer, serious as all hell. Willa Sachs is back as Cassandra Rampart, was printed in big letters. Rory's name was in the cluttered billing block at the bottom of the poster, in typeface the same size as that of the film's editor. Irene kept him plied with green tea, protein bars, and small bowls of blueberries. The movie was promoted on CBS This Morning the entire week. Every morning at 7:40 and 8:10, Rory reported the national weather in front of a green screen map. Willa was a guest host with Kelly Ripa on Live with Kelly. The two women did Pilates on the air. The premiere of the film was supposed to take place on one of the piers on the Hudson. Special facilities had been constructed with seating for 5,000 people, but a predicted thunderstorm put the kibosh on that. Instead, cinema screens all over the city were booked for simultaneous digital projections of the movie. Rory and Irene were delivered to every one of them by SUV, a total of 29 personal appearances. Willa Sachs attended only the special screening held at the Museum of Natural History to raise money for its programs for young scientists. At the end of 9 days of the domestic press junket, Rory was exhausted, talked out, dizzy. He had seen little more than cars and rooms and cameras. Worst of all, the questions had been the same for 400-plus interviews. What is it like working with Willa Sachs? What is it like kissing Willa Sachs? Is that really your butt in the hurricane scene? Rory now felt that working with Willa Sachs was like eating a peanut butter sandwich on a motorcycle. Kissing Willa Sachs was like Christmas in July, and the butt in the hurricane was that of a talking horse named Britches. Welcome to the big leagues, Punkin, Irene told him. Tomorrow, Rome. Willa Sachs flew to Italy on a chartered plane, along with her team, her posse, and her handlers. The studio plane took the other 5 producers, all the executives, and the marketing heads. With no seats available for either Rory or Irene, they flew business class on TraxJet Airways, changing planes in Frankfurt. 3 days of press were held in Rome, each as busy as those in the U.S. On the last night, the teaser was shown outside at the Circo Massimo, where the chariot races were held in ancient times. To Rory, it looked just like a big field. Scenes from the movie were projected onto a huge temporary screen, but not until after a local soccer team was presented with a trophy they had won in some championship. The crowd was estimated at 21,000. When Rory appeared on stage to wave to the Romans, nothing happened. When Willa appeared to do the same, fistfights broke out as a tide of fans in soccer jerseys rushed the barricades to get to her. The Italian Carabinieri got into a melee with the thugs as Willa was hustled into an armored car and whisked away to the airport. The next morning, Rory and Irene took a commercial flight, Air Flugplatz, to Berlin, where another 3 days of press were on tap. In Berlin, Rory's body clock was so jet-lagged that he found himself flush with energy at 3 a.m., so he went out for a run. Leaving the hotel, he was ignored by the dozens of fervent German Cassandra Rampart fans who'd lingered all night and would continue to do so all morning, hoping for a glimpse of her. He jogged along the dark paths of the Tier Garden, stopping to do push-ups on the steps of a monument to the Russian army, complete with actual tanks that crushed Berlin in 1945. At noon the next day, he was so tired he felt like a sleepwalker. He talked like one, too, telling the entire staff of Bild, the national newspaper, that as both a fan of the movies and the latest co-star of Willa Sex, he actually said sex instead of sax, he felt that Sandra Caspart was the most complimental and sophisticated of any and all films, for Willa Sex's heroine for our times, and a woman of four ages. Then came the questions. What is it like working with Willa Sex? What is it like kissing Willa Sex? Is that really your butt in the hurricane scene? Try not to call her Willa Sex, Irene told him in the car, back to the hotel. When did I do that? Rory asked. Just now, to Germany's largest daily newspaper. Sorry, he said. I'm no longer sure what the words are that come out of my mouth. The German screening of the teaser took place later that night, projected onto the Brandenburg Gate to 6,000 fans. When she appeared at the balcony of the hotel to wave to them, Willa Sex was disappointed there were no fistfights. I guess I'm no Willa Sex tonight, she said, at the gala dinner afterward, held in the same museum that displays Nefertiti's bust. By the time Rory and Irene had flown to London, Compuware into Gatwick, the international press junket had turned Rory into blabbering toast.
Day 2. 7:30, grooming in room. 8, transfer by car to Gare de l'Est. 8:10 to 9, red carpet interviews prior to boarding Cassandra Express. 9:05 to 1300, train ride to Aix-en-Provence. En route 15-minute interviews and special media car, outlet list available on request. 1300 to 1400, red carpet interviews upon arrival at Ancient Roman Theater. 1430 to 1600, Ancient Roman Theater, recreation of hurricane scene for press. Note, this is broadcast live on Rai Due TV. 1630, reboard Cassandra Express, live appearance on Midi and Madi, TV broadcast from observation car. 1715 to 2145, return to Paris via Cassandra Express, en route 15-minute interviews for non-French media in special media car, outlet list available on request. 2200, transfer by car to cocktail reception dinner at Hotel Maurice, hosted by Facebook France. After dinner, you are free to stay or return to hotel. Irene will be provided the advance schedule for Asia before arrival in Singapore/Tokyo. Getting the job was a fluke, a scratch-off lottery win. Rory had given up on Los Angeles after a 6-month stint as a model, actor, bartender, with all of 2 credits on his SAG-AFTRA card. He'd booked a yogurt commercial playing touch football on a beach. For 3 cloudy days in San Diego, he ran around shirtless. Rory looked damn fine without a shirt. With a group of racially mixed pals, then they all snacked on yogurt. They were coached on how to dip the spoons into the mini-packs and place the yogurt in their mouths. There was a trick to it. 9 weeks later, he was cast in a 1-episode role on the rebranded Kojak series for CBS. Rory played a tattooed, shaved-head meth dealer who was pretending to be a handicapped Iraq War veteran, so obviously he had to die. Rory met his end in high style, shirtless, of course, dragged off the roof of an office building by his fraudulently gained motorized wheelchair, new Kojak jumping to safety just in time. With little else going on but car payments and gym workouts, Rory grew bored with Southern California and took his yogurt Kojak money to Utah for the ski season. When New Kojak finally aired, one of the several other producers on Cassandra happened to be watching and texted Willa Sex. I think I saw CR's next bit of honey. A few days later, Rory got a call from his agency to get back to town because something huge was on deck in the